Good morning. I'm Marianne Barasonic, and this is Between the Covers. My guest today is Mary Robinette Kowal. She received the Campbell Award for Best New Writer in 2008. In 2009, she was a Hugo nominee for her story Evil Robot Monkey. Her debut novel is just out, Shades of Milk and Honey, and it's a blend of Jane Austen and magic. And Mary lives right here in Portland. Thank you for coming in.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
We've got kind of a, this is a difficult follow-up for the show that we just had that was kind of a heavy duty, and they were talking a lot about women's issues. And I think kind of a nice segue into your book is to talk a little bit about, this is set in the Regency period.
That's correct. It's in 1814.
And you actually are imitating Jane Austen's style.
To a certain degree, I'm also trying to update it a little bit for a modern reader, but it's very much in her style, and certainly in terms of the plot, which is all about getting married, which was at the time for a young lady of quality, the thing that meant a life of comfort or the poorhouse.
There were no other choices.
She could be a governess, but otherwise it was basically she was entirely dependent on her relatives. Women were not allowed to have property. So once they got married, everything went to their husband. Frequently, fathers could not pass their property down to their daughters. So it was very much a man's world.
And, you know, it's interesting contrasting that with what's going on in the Middle East right now, because we look at women's conditions there and we're just horrified. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't so long ago that that women were living under similar conditions in Europe.
Yes. And England in particular was very, very closed society. The second book, which comes out in 2012, happens in France, and so I was having to research the differences between England and the continent, and I was really surprised by how much more liberated French women were.
What can you give me an example of what?
Well, one of the things is a very simple and seemingly innocuous thing. After dinner in an English Regency home, the ladies would depart to the parlor, and the men would stay in the dining room and talk politics. In France, everybody stayed and talked politics.
So the women were allowed a voice.
Yes, yes, and were decision makers, but not so in England.
That's really interesting, and I don't want to give our listeners the idea that this is a heavy duty feminist track, because this is not. It's definitely in the Jane Austen style,
right?
But the difference is this is really a fantasy novel.
Yes, yes.
And you've just added this glamour.
Mm-hmm. So the idea that I had, I love Jane Austen, and I've been a science fiction and fantasy reader forever. But one of the things that I love about Jane Austen is that she does these small-scale, intimate stories that are about people and relationships. And fantasy has a tendency to need an evil overlord.
Oh, there is not a single swashbuckling, sword-wielding hero or an evil overlord or a threat to the entire planet.
No. There is nothing like that in this. So what I was interested in was what would happen to fantasy if I tried to put it into a Jane Austen world. And the biggest challenge that I had was not breaking the Regency. I kept having to, when I was developing the magic system, make it gentler. It's almost entirely illusionary. So, because if I had them able to do things that were, you know, like blow things up, that would completely have changed the Napoleonic Wars. It would have changed everything. So I couldn't do that. So I had to keep stripping it back. And the other thing that I needed was, because I wanted my main character to be a young woman, I needed it to be something that she would do, which meant that magic became a woman's art. So it's something that young ladies of quality need to learn to do, like they need to learn needlepoint and dancing and music. They need to learn how to do magic.
And this magic is just kind of manipulating light, mm-hmm. so that you create illusions.
Yes. So it's, you know, you paint your living room and then you come in and you use glamour to make the illusion of palm trees and egrets to complement your Egyptian revival furniture.
Why don't we give the listeners a little flavor of the book? Can you read for us?
Certainly. This is from chapter 10, and Jane is at her upstairs with her mother, who has been a little bit ill, and Jane is a little out of sorts herself. And I should preface this before I start, actually, by saying that I recorded the audiobook and they had me do it with a British dialect. Now, when I recorded it, I had a dialect coach in the room with me to correct me. She is not here now. So
we will forgive you any Americanisms that creep into your British.
But unfortunately, because I've practiced it with the British, it's hard to not do that. So here we go.
Jane went upstairs to her mother's rooms and spent a quarter hour helping Mrs. Ellsworth with the arrangement of her pillows, which were not fluffed enough, and then were lofted too high, and with the blankets, which were too hot, and then too cold, when she heard the front door close. "Who do you suppose that is?" Mrs. Ellsworth queried. "I'm sure I do not know. It might be the Dunkirks departing, or Mr. Vincent." "Well, go and look at once. My nerves cannot abide not knowing." Jane went to the window, and seeing the figures on horseback ride down the front sweep, said, "It was Mr. and Miss Dunkirk on the way to Robinsford Abbey," which meant that Melody was now alone with Mr. Dunkirk, with Mr. Vincent. Well, Jane need not rescue Melody from that quarter. He may torture her with silence and with his brusque nature, but he would not do anything to inspire any real danger of impropriety from Melody. So Jane stayed by her mother's side, adjusting all the small comforts needed to ease her fretting. She had just begun to read to her from William Meinhold's Sidonia the Sorceress, the supposed destroyer of the whole reigning ducal house of Pomerania, when the distant sound of the front door opening and shutting interrupted her recital.
That's wonderful.
Thank you. And I should say that Sidonia the Sorceress was a real book.
Was it really?
Yes. Every book that I have them reading is something that would have been available at the time. And that was rough. It's a little bit earlier than Jane Austen, but I tried to pick books that were actually fantasies. So I ran across that and I was like, oh.
So it sounds like you're kind of a research junkie.
I try not to let it get in the way of actually writing the books, but yeah, I get kind of, it's the best form of procrastination in the world.
Yes, I can understand that completely. Now, we talked a little bit about how this is a fantasy book, mm-hmm. but it strays very far from the norms of the genre.
Yes.
And have you had a problem getting it accepted? Because of that?
It's funny. It turns out that this is a book for a very specific kind of reader. I've had people who will say this is the book that they have been waiting for, and then I've had people who cannot wait for the plot to start. and I'm like, actually, the plot starts at the beginning, which is
they want that evil overlord.
Yes, they're looking for the evil overlord. And I'm like, and the plot pretty much starts on page one, which is, is she going to get married or not? I mean, like, that's the plot. So I think it's confusing to people who are used to traditional fantasies.
Now, have you heard a lot from the serious Jane Austen people?
They have been embracing this much more than I was afraid that there would be a lot of kickback because I do borrow heavily from Miss Austen. And there are also liberties that I take. There are things in the latter half of the book which are plot elements in Jane Austen, but she has them happen off stage. And, you know, that's not something that I could do for a modern audience, I felt. You know, in Jane Austen, you'll have duels and mad horse chases and all of these other things that are reported to the heroines. And
because that's the way that they would have seen life.
Yes,
everything
yes.
was happening elsewhere and was just being reported to them.
Exactly. But one of the themes in this book is about my main character, Jane, discovering her own inner passions. And so I felt like I wanted the book to become less restrained as it went on.
Now, were you influenced at all by Pride and Prejudice and zombies?
No, because I wrote this significantly before that came out.
So you were there first.
I was totally there first. Yeah, it's the process of selling a book just takes a really long time. So I actually wrote this in 2006, and I had the idea in 2005.
Ah, so it's just been taking a long time. Now, apparently this novel started out as a National Novel Writing Month project.
That's correct.
The NaNoWriMo.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently there's some controversy about that.
Yeah, there are people who think that NaNoWriMo is a stunt, because basically the idea is that you sit down and you write a novel in a month. And a novel is defined as 50,000 words. And the point of NaNoWriMo is to get people over their fear of writing. Because everybody says, someday I'm going to write a novel. But they don't sit down and do it. And the thing that NaNo does is it creates a definable goal that's achievable but hard. It works out to writing about 1,600 words a day, which is totally doable and something that you pretty much have to do if you're doing this professionally. And if you do that, then at the end of a month, you have 50,000 words.
And not necessarily a novel. I guess a lot of the criticism came from agents who, after this month was over, got a lot of not well-written short novels.
Yes. So that's what the downside to this is, that some people, and not the majority of the people, but there is a contingent of people who will hit the 50,000 words, think that they have a completed novel, and send it out without revisions. But these are people, I think, that would probably do that anyway, you know, because it displays a certain lack of judgment. Most of the people who write are either doing it because it's something that they just want to do, or because it's a way to give themselves discipline, and then they sit down and revise and submit later. And I fall into that category. I will use it as a way to make myself write to deadline, and then I will sit down, revise, and spend like 2 or 3 months writing the remaining 20 or 30,000 words, however much I need for the novel.
Do you usually like start right at the beginning and write all the way through, or do you wind up having to do a lot of this back and forth and back and forth, write so far and then say, ooh, that top part doesn't work and let's go back and fix that? And
I tend to layer things. I do write in a linear stream, so I start at the beginning and write forward, but sometimes I'll be in, you know, chapter 5 and realize that, oh, for chapter 5 I really need him to have a walking stick and I should plant that in chapter 2. So I'll go back and put the walking stick in chapter 2. Sometimes I'll just put in a bracket to remind myself, go back and fix this later. But I write to outline and start at the beginning and move forward. And I will adjust the outline as I go. Although the interesting thing with Shades of Milk and Honey is that when I was doing NaNo, I felt the novel going wrong, but it was still following the outline and I kept going. And then I got to the 50,000 words, looked at what I was writing and said, no, I was right. That was going off track. And so I wound up tossing 20,000 words.
That set you back a bit.
It did set me back a bit. Although the thing that's beautiful about writing is that there are never wasted words. It will teach you something about character, and frequently there are scenes that you can salvage and reuse.
Yes. So how does your puppetry background influence your writing?
It influences it, I think, in the way I look at character and body language. One of the things that the written word and puppetry has in common is that it's very difficult to show facial expressions. You know, I can write on the page, she lifted her eyebrow a quarter inch over, and, you know, I can get very specific, but that tells you nothing.
Right. It's like trying to describe a shade of blue by telling you what part of the spectrum it is.
Exactly. So with puppetry, we wind up using body language a lot to define what is happening, the broader strokes, so to speak. And I find that I do that a lot with my writing, that I'm much more likely to describe a character's overall physicality. For instance, if I say that the training exercise that we have in puppetry is the line, "What did you say?" And if I wrote, "What did you say?" She leaned forward, breath coming quickly, versus, "What did you say?" She slammed her beer down and pushed her chair back. It gives you two very different emotional responses. And so I find that I tend to do things like that a little perhaps more consciously than other writers. Or
puppetry is not a common career. How did you get into puppetry? I'm sure you get asked that a lot.
Yes. And you know, it's funny because I know so many puppeteers.
And you're like, oh, what? You aren't a puppeteer?
I know. Well, I did puppetry for 20 years. I was professionally. When I was in high school, I was one of those – I was one of those kids who just wanted to do everything. And puppetry came the closest to combining everything that I was interested in. So
So do you make the puppets yourself?
I make the puppets. I'm actually working on a production of Odd and the Frost Giants by Neil Gaiman for a theater in Houston right now, Stages Theater, that opens in May. So I make the puppets, I perform, I design. I'm shifting more and more to writing.
Writing for puppets, which has got to be different than writing for human actors.
No, I meant writing writing fiction. I don't.
Oh, okay.
I almost never write scripts. I was very fortunate when I was really starting out that I got partnered with a man named Jody Eichelberger, who went on to be in Broadway on Avenue Q. And he's a wonderful, wonderful writer. And so he would write most of almost everything that we worked on. I think I wrote one short that we worked on together, but everything else was his, which actually wound up having the effect of making me stop writing fiction for about 10 years because I was getting my creative jollies from the visual part of my life and was working with someone who was so good that I didn't feel the burning urge in quite the same way.
Right. But now you're going to focus more on your fiction.
Yes.
And there's a sequel to Shades of Milk and Honey coming out?
Yes, it's called Glamour and Glass, and it comes out in early 2012. I'm sure this will not surprise anyone that at the end of Shades of Milk and Honey, matrimony ensues, being Jane Austen. And Glamour and Glass is what happens with the married couple. I'll preserve you from knowing who gets married to whom. But the interesting thing about 1814 and 1815 is that in 1814, Napoleon goes into exile. And for the first time, it's safe to go to the continent. So, of course, the happily married couple goes for their honeymoon. But in 1815, Napoleon comes out of exile, and that's when the Hundred Days' War starts.
Ah, so that sounds like a whole lot of research.
It was a whole lot of research, and it's a little more swashbuckling than Shades of Milk and Honey because, you know, let's face it, there's an evil overlord this time. We got Napoleon.
Well, he doesn't really fit the mold of the true fantasy novel,
no.
Evil Overlord. There isn't a lot of explanation on the page in this book about exactly what glamour is. We see it. Mm-hmm. We see people manipulating it. How much background did you do to kind of get the rules of this magic? And how did you decide what to put in and what to leave out?
I did a fair bit. Mr. Vincent, who is the professional glamorist in the book, is a bit of an inventor, so I needed to know what had been invented and what natural progressions were likely. Optics in the real world were being heavily explored already. So that's a background that I knew that they would have had. The deep story, which is the point where this world deviates from ours, is that fairy and the mortal world never separated. So everybody's got a little bit of fairy blood. And in theory, what's happening here is that that allows them, with their second sight, to manipulate the electromagnetic spectrum.
Ah. So they wind up having fairy blood, but are still as staid and kind of unemotional as the British were then.
Yes. Well, you know, it's a very, very solid model that.
Yes.
So they're manipulating the electromagnetic spectrum roughly. I mean, it's clearly magic. And if you look at it too closely, the entire theory falls apart. But there are things that I do. For instance, there's nowhere in the book where I think I've got one person who does a very small warming spell. But heat is not something that people generate using glamour. And that's because in my world, that's them manipulating microwaves, which will kill you.
Right. That would be painful.
That would be painful. And what I decided was that the shorter the wavelength, the more difficult it was to control and maintain, and the faster the glamour would degrade. So,
see, I think that's fascinating that you spent that much time thinking about how this all works. But there isn't a lot of that. And I suppose that makes sense, because what you're trying to do is like put together the kind of, as one of my writer friends puts it, the meatball science behind it. But the characters wouldn't know any of that.
Right. Well, Mr. Vincent actually would. And Jane would have an awareness of it, but it's not the sort of conversation that one has in the drawing room. In Glamour and Glass, we do have a lot more discussion, because there's a school for glamour that turns up partway in the book. And so there are more, scientific discussions of glamour. But for the most part, it's a woman's art, and the language involving it is all womanly terms, you know, weaving and threads and braiding and things like that.
What is it about the Regency period that you think people find so compelling?
Oh, well, the clothes are very pretty. Oh, I love the clothes. I think a lot of it is that although we tend to think of it as being this very repressed period, it was actually fairly loose and racy. I know that the Victorian
that you're going to have to back up with something.
Oh yeah, no, I can. The Victorian period was a reaction to the loose morals of the Regency. It was actually possible for a young lady to, to go into town without a chaperone. It didn't happen that often, but it was possible to do. In the Victorian period, significantly less so.
Okay,
but,
I'm sorry. But racy and going into town without a chaperone is...
You know, at the time, if a young lady was unaccompanied in Jane Austen, although it is frowned upon when Marianne goes out driving with Willoughby, it's not so shocking that her social chances are completely ruined. And you have to remember what they're coming from.
What's shocking about that is how repressive that is.
Yeah.
That is amazing, because you think about how constricted women's lives were. But this was just the upper class.
This was mostly just the upper class, largely because the underclass, the working class, didn't have time for any of this. But, you know, a servant, you know, a maidservant working in a home wasn't allowed to date. And that actually continued for, gosh, into the early 1900s. But it was a period. It was also, I think, part of the other thing that is attractive to the Regency is that it was a period of great change.
Yes, that would have been the time when all of a sudden the understanding of things like electricity and the optics and so the technologies were just coming fast.
Right. And fashion as well. And when you look at Jane Austen's mother or Mrs. Ellsworth in her youth would have worn paniers, you know, those big honkin' skirts. And then she's essentially living in a period where the clothing, the formal clothing is the nightgown, you know.
Ah, much different.
Much different. And young ladies, this is the other very racy thing that they would do. Young ladies would dampen their dresses to make them clingier and more transparent.
Oh, well, that is kind of racy.
It really is.
You've got instructions on a web page on how to turn your laptop into something that resembles a manual typewriter.
Yes.
That, I thought, was very clever. What prompted you to do this?
We collect typewriters. I have 14 of them, and they're so beautiful, but I like writing on the computer. It's much easier.
You know, I've actually tried writing on a manual typewriter, and I think you have to build up strength in your fingers.
You do, although you can adjust the weight depending on the typewriter. So I will occasionally write on the typewriter, but it's not practical. And I thought, you know, people used to make things that were beautiful and practical. Why can't I still have that? And so I put stickers on my computer to make it look like a typewriter.
Well, it's more than just stickers, isn't it? Because, like, the keys are different and everything.
It's just stickers.
It's just stickers?
Oh. I put wood veneer on the space bar.
Ah, okay. Well, you've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm Marianne Barasonic, and my guest has been Mary Robinette Kowal. Now, you have like a blog where if people want to kind of keep up with what you're doing, they can take a look at it.
Yes, absolutely. It's maryrobinettekowal.com. Very long. Although if you write shadesofmilkandhoney.com, which is easier to spell, you will get there as well.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.